And if you've got your Bibles, you're going to want to keep them open to Ecclesiastes, a weird book. And this morning's sermon is going to be a weird sermon. I was once told that sermons should take on the genre and the sort of experience of the passages that you're preaching. And so Ecclesiastes is weird, and so there may be some weirdness to this for you. But stay with me. I think it'll be good. You can be the judge. Don't judge too harshly. So moving into Ecclesiastes, we're reminded that we are moving from Proverbs. In many ways, my life aligns with the wisdom of Proverbs. Throughout the book of Proverbs, you hear the wisdom that hard work and wise planning have positive results. So for instance, Proverbs 21:5 says, "The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance." When I hear this, I sometimes think back to a really incredible project I was a part of. Most of you know that during my senior year of high school, I was a brand new Christian. Well, I was also the student body president of my high school, of Granada. And as the student body president, I had the chance to lead a team of people who completely overhauled Granada's annual sort of homecoming calendar and schedule and events. And a former principal of Granada once said that the changes that this group got to make to homecoming actually changed the culture of Granada for at least a decade, which is cool. When I look back, that was a moment where I invested everything I had, worked so hard, made what felt like wise plans, and we created something really cool that we were excited to look at and offer. It was a great experience. Sometimes I look back at the work that it took for me to finish seminary. And I think about Proverbs 14:23. In all hard work, there's profit, but mere talk leads to poverty. So I started my degree 8 months before Jane and I had Rebecca, our first baby. I then spent 3.5 years working at seminary part-time, traveling to Kansas City twice a year while I was a full-time youth pastor and a dad to a little one. And then after 3.5 years, we moved to Kansas City so that I could go to school full time. And then in that last year and a half, I was working part time as a youth pastor and we had a second baby. And so after 5 long years, I received the profit of my hard work. I had a degree in hand. When I read in the book of Proverbs, Solomon's wisdom around rejoicing in the wife of your youth, I think of the ways that Jane and I have worked at our marriage through the years. In April, it'll be 15 years. And as it gets closer, I've been reflecting on the ways that we've rejoiced in the gift of each other and have cultivated a growing love for each other. As a youth pastor for almost 10 years, I was deeply committed to Proverbs 22:6. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And again, I experienced this wisdom, supporting parents, coming alongside them, doing my part to teach teenagers about Jesus, and then watching them grow up into mature followers of Jesus. It's maybe one of the greatest joys of my life. And then there is its character. I've longed to live a life of integrity. I try to be honest in all of my dealings. I've tried to look out for the marginalized, the weak, those who don't have a voice, those without. I've tried to do what is right over and over again. The Proverbs tell us that a righteous life is blessed by God. Obviously, you'll have to decide for yourself whether I actually live any of this out, but for certain I have failed and in any and all of these areas. And when I have, I've listened again to Proverbs like 22:4 that say, the reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. And so I've tried to humbly confess my sin when I've fallen short of God's righteous standard, to repent and to keep submitting my life to him. And then there's my work as pastor. And I've been at this thing for almost 8 years, and almost every single day I wake up, and if you can't tell, if you don't know this yet, you'll recognize one of the biggest differences between Jane and I in what she said earlier about her waking up each day and my waking up. I wake up not just ready for the day, but excited about the work that I get to do. This is a personality thing. But it also has something to do with just this intense love that I have for pastoring God's people. And in many ways, I've seen the truth behind Proverbs 16:3. Commit your work to the Lord and your plans will be established. So if you look closely at my life, you can see the wisdom and the truth of Proverbs. I've dedicated my life to Jesus and I've given myself entirely to his service. And if you trace my life from senior year until now, you can see this clear trail of blessing in my wake. From changing the culture of an entire school to completing seminary to rebuilding, to building a strong marriage and developing mature spiritual children to the blessings that come with character and humility to the favor of God in my work as a pastor. Not only is there blessing, but my life has been relatively free of suffering. I mean, sure, like I deal with some hard stuff and some heavy stuff here and there, but for the most part, my suffering has been incredibly light. And the book of Proverbs would say that this is because I walk with Jesus and I make good choices. Ecclesiastes, the wisdom book that comes right after Proverbs, would say, this is because I've just been lucky. Ecclesiastes says, I've just been lucky. Ecclesiastes reminds us that there are plenty of people who have lived far more righteously, far more wisely than me. If you know I am, amens there. Cool, okay. People whose lives are also filled with suffering. In fact, some of the most godly people I know cannot get themselves out of life's hardships. No matter how hard they work, they just cannot seem to get a break. And then there are plenty of people, the kind of people that Proverbs would call fools, who are doing really well for themselves. Their lives are filled with success and accomplishments and comfort and relationships, although there's no evidence that they deserve any of it. So, like, which is it, right? This is an important question. Proverbs, which says, I'm blessed. It's easy to put a hashtag on it, post it all over social media. Or Ecclesiastes, which says, I'm lucky. That doesn't hashtag quite as well. Listen again with me to the voice of Ecclesiastes, to the son of David, often associated with Solomon, even though he's not named here. But I want you to hear chapter 2, starting in verse 4. We heard it once, but I want you to hear what he has to say as he reflects on all of his accomplishments. Chapter 2, verse 4. I'm reading out of the ESV, the English Standard Version. Listen to what he says. He says, I made great works. If this sounds a little bit like the bragging that I started with, this is the reason. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Notice what he just said there. I made myself pools from which to water the forest. I made the ability for trees to continue living. I mean, this is a claim of sort of divine ability. I bought male and female slaves. I had slaves who were born in my house. I had also, in this time, that would have been a sign of prosperity and of power. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained in me, with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. All was vanity, striving after the wind. Let me say something quickly about these two verses that basically run through this entire book of Ecclesiastes. So the word vanity here in the ESV is translated a million different ways. Every translation trying to find a creative way to capture this powerful image. So literally, the word hevel refers to the breath we exhale. So if you could just picture that cold day, you walk out of the house and you breathe. And for a moment you see it, it's there, but then it's gone. People have often translated this hard to translate word as mere breath or vapor. Or fleeting. Not only something that doesn't last, but something that exists for only a moment. But if you think about the air that we exhale, we're actually talking about air that no longer has any use for us. Right? It can no longer be breathed in. We are breathing out a waste byproduct. And so this word often carries the idea of something that is worthless or useless. Then consider the word picture right next to vanity, striving after the wind. One translation perfectly captures this as grasping for the wind. Right, you can picture the sheer meaninglessness of trying to grab the wind in order to accomplish anything. Right? It's a complete waste of time and effort to grasp the wind. This is how the king in Ecclesiastes looks at every single one of his accomplishments. His treasuries are overflowing. He has gained more fame, more praise, more wealth, more power than anyone could hope or imagine. And yet he looks at it all and he realizes it is as useful to him as exhaled breath. He looks at his life as this series of failed attempts to grasp hold of wind and use it. And he's going to go on reflecting on this again and again. He's going to come back to the exact same place. What good are treasuries and fame and praise and wealth and power when you die? What are you going to do with it all? And in chapter 3, verse 19, he's going to observe that all people face not just the same end, but the same end as the animals. Humanity, supposedly the pinnacle of God's creation, saved for the final day, it faced the same death that the rest of the animals face. I mean, animals, right? They just simply live their lives, mostly doing what they're programmed to, except for cats. We know. But, David's just shaking his head. It's like, I hate you. Cats are the worst, if you don't know this. Animals just do what they're made to do. But humans, mighty humans, like, we build civilizations. We cure smallpox, create democracy, invent iPhones. And we're still gonna all die. Like every other ordinary animal. Chapter 9, verse 2, he takes this in a slightly different way. Chapter 9, verse 2, he says, it's the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the bad, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice, right? To the one who worships God and the one who doesn't worship God. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he who swears an oath is as he who shuns an oath. This is a bad. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun. That the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. Terrible human beings sometimes go on to live really, really long lives, while the best among us sometimes die way too early. But in the end, it doesn't matter. If you were the literal worst person who ever lived, or the best, because there is no escaping the same fate. Death is coming for us all. No amens? Ah, gosh, I really thought that was going to get one. Just kidding. Right? Who's ready to celebrate? And we have to be careful. Don't you even dare start throwing around cliches and nice platitudes. Well, it's all in God's plan. No! The speaker of Ecclesiastes would say that is overly simplistic nonsense. That's the stuff of Proverbs. That the wicked and the righteous would share the same death, that's not God's plan. That's bad, he says. It's not God's design. Just think about it. Ecclesiastes begs us. Just think about it. Seriously, think about life. Think about who God is. Think about the way this all works. Just think about it. You will realize immediately that life is far more complex than Proverbs makes it out to be. But it can be so hard to think about it. Because when I do think about it, the way that I look at my life has to change, right? I can't simply declare, good stuff happens to me, I must be blessed, or I must be righteous. The assessments I make, they begin to shift between categories of black and white, and they begin to take on these shades of gray. So last year, I was talking with some seniors at Granada High School, where I was the student body president. They were getting ready for homecoming. And can you believe none of them knew I was part of developing their homecoming plans? In fact, it's changed so much over the last 18 years, it hardly looks like the thing I helped create. I put so much time and effort into that thing. Like, I gave myself to it completely. For what? There's no recognition in it. It hasn't endured through the years. And what about my seminary degree? I spent 5 years on tens of thousands of dollars. Jane, was it worth it? Don't answer that. You may not know this, but most people don't care that I went to seminary. Most people don't care that I have a degree. And often I find that it's actually an obstacle, as a lot of people distrust a seminary education or feel threatened by it in some way. And you know, the work that Jane and I have put into our marriage, you know, the truth is, tomorrow could be the day that either one of us takes our last breath. And what would we have to show for all of the work? We'd have two kids and a life that now fall on one of us to continue to carry. And what about every teenager whose faith I helped establish and sustain? How many of them grew up to be mature followers of Jesus only to walk away from the faith at some point in adulthood? And what good is my character if it means that I die the same death as someone who never gave a second thought to theirs? Ecclesiastes asks this specific question. And what do I make of the fact that tomorrow, every single one of you could decide to pack it in and call it quits? That this thing called discovery could end tomorrow? Just like that. After almost 15 years of literal blood, sweat, and tears. I was a youth pastor here for a long time. All three of those are relevant. But I'm not just being dramatic by saying, oh, you know, who knows what could happen tomorrow. Every local congregation in the New Testament and in the first 100 years of the church is long gone. It just no longer exists. Churches are born. And churches die, every single one of them, just like people. There is a season for everything, Ecclesiastes tells us. But Ecclesiastes is a bit rude or brutal in the way that it tells us about this time for everything. See, because it starts in chapter 3 announcing there's a time to be born. And there's a time to die, which frames the rest of this list, right? Because all the stuff that happens between birth and death still ends in death. And so Ecclesiastes doesn't want us to forget this, that the last season of our lives is always death. Everything that we plant will die or it'll be plucked up. Everything that humans build with our own brilliance and strength will crumble at some point. Every laugh over a new birth for a baby will be followed by the tears of that child's death. Maybe 80 years later, but maybe not. Dancing will be followed by mourning. Everything we gather will be scattered again. Everything we find will be lost. Everything that is sewn together will eventually be torn apart. Who's feeling encouraged? This is, according to some, a dark outlook. Some are shocked when they read Ecclesiastes. It feels so unspiritual. But others have seen in Ecclesiastes its necessary realism. After all of Proverbs' quotes about how to have your best life now, after 31 chapters of Proverbs that are easily Instagrammable, right? Whatever they are, that we need to get our feet back on the ground, to take a real look at this life that God has made for us. You'll recognize some places where Ecclesiastes has influenced me through the years. as the speaker is running through this list of seasons in chapter 3, a time to kill and a time to heal. You might actually recall some of our time in the Gospels, reflecting on Jesus's life and his ministry, specifically the healing ministry of Jesus, because I've challenged you again and again to consider the fact that Lazarus, raised from the dead by the resurrection power of our God, died again. And then the blind men who were given sight, if they didn't go blind again later by sheer old age, they died. And then there were those who were healed of leprosy who, if they didn't go off and die in war, died of old age or whatever they died of, they died too. And then the people who were healed of paralysis, who experienced an intervention of God's powerful spirit in their lives, they were set free, they could move again, only to move into the grave over time. Like, this is the reality of these stories that we read in the Gospels. Proverbs trains us to hear Jesus say, right? Proverbs that we've been in for weeks say things like, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open to you. And we, Proverbs trains us to believe that it's that simple. But Ecclesiastes reminds us that Proverbs are often true. If you ask, it will often be given to you. But not always. The wisdom of asking God is not the same thing as a promise that God will always give. Do you hear that? Wisdom is not the same thing as a promise. And Ecclesiastes trains us to think through the difference, to discern, which is a spiritual discipline. We need to be trained because it doesn't come naturally to us to determine between what is wisdom and promise. And this is where I want to show you something that I think is really cool. And it builds on what I suggested last week as we were in Proverbs 30 and 31 and being surprised by where we might find wisdom or insights outside of the church and scripture. The discoveries that are being made within the fields of psychology and neuroscience today are actually confirming the genius of our scriptures. So, I don't know if you know this, maybe you do from your church experience, but there are people, there are pastors, preachers who will never preach the book of Proverbs because they believe that the Proverbs are too simplistic. They're too oriented to the things that we do and a works righteousness, that they're too easy to misunderstand. They require too much explanation for all of the times when they don't work out. And so they're often ignored by preachers. And there are also preachers who will never preach Ecclesiastes. This one might feel easier to believe, right? If you read enough commentaries and reflections on this book, you will quickly discover there are lots of people who aren't sure this book belongs in the scriptures. But here's what I think. Psychologists and neuroscientists have determined that there are two distinct systems in our brains, and that each system has a different purpose and needs something different. I'll call them, these are oversimplifications, but hang with me, the lazy brain and the deep brain. Both are important, both are necessary, and here's what I want to suggest. Proverbs addresses the needs, the real needs of the lazy brain. And Ecclesiastes addresses the needs of the deep brain. So, the lazy brain, I realized calling it the lazy brain would make all of us go, ah, that's a bad brain. But it's not bad. It's God-given, and it has a purpose. And it's this. You cannot, I promise, you cannot think deeply about every single thing you have to do every single day, right? You can't reflect deeply on every action you take, every decision you make. You simply cannot do it. You're incapable. You don't have the energy to do that. You don't have the time to do that. And so our brains, our lazy brain, establishes really helpful shortcuts. We might call them habits. We might even call them biases and automatic responses. Everything that is instinctive or automatic comes from the lazy part of our brain. The part that goes, I don't have time to think about that, and so I'm just gonna do it. Okay? All of these are made automatic on purpose so that you don't have to think deeply about every decision you face. So your lazy brain has developed shortcuts so that when you're walking down the street, your brain instinctively warns you about who might be dangerous. Your lazy brain automatically fills in the gaps when you don't have them. So someone stood you up for some meeting, and your brain immediately fills in the gaps. They must have forgotten. Unless you know the person well, and your lazy brain tells you instinctively, well, their alarm probably didn't go off. But whatever it is, it's your lazy brain telling you automatically what's going on, making sense of the gap between moments. Proverbs trains your lazy brain to develop habits that you will automatically live if you're living a godly life. So like your instinct may become over time to tell the truth. Because of your lazy brain, you won't have to think in every single encounter, do I tell the truth here? Do I not? Am I honest? But you will develop by default, by instinct, a certain pattern. Unless you encounter a situation that doesn't really make sense, or you push yourself to consider it more deeply, then the decision moves to your deep brain, the place where you do deeper level thinking, where you might think to yourself, I know that I always tell the truth and that honesty is a core part of who I am, but maybe it's okay here to be dishonest with my daughter so that she'll be surprised when she shows up for her party. Right? That's a decision that we make. Your deep brain is the place where we think more deeply about life and about God and about the way the world works. It's the place where we consider how to act, how to live in a specific scenario that isn't covered by our instincts or habits, right? When our instincts or habits fall short and we're like, I don't know what to do, we have to think about that. Your deep brain is the place where you analyze and where you assess. Your lazy brain is the place where you love God with all of your strength. You cultivate practices over time that become habits so that with your hands and your feet and your entire life, you love God in this deeply habitual, instinctive sort of way. But your deep brain is the place where you love God with all of your mind, bringing before him your habits and your instincts and saying, God, where do these need to be changed? Where do I need new habits or new instincts? It's the place where you move past just doing things because you'll get a reward. Because Proverbs says it's going to make your life better. Where you discover that you are called to live a particular way of life because of who God is. The lazy brain prays because praying is good or beneficial, but our deep brain helps us keep praying even when it's not clear that prayer is working. You've had that experience, right? Where you have prayed and you have prayed and no answer comes and there's no sense that God is hearing your prayer and you just continue praying and you wonder, does God hear? He says, ask and it will be given to you. Our deep brain helps us keep praying because our deep brain takes us to a place where we are able to think about who God is, to remember his promises, that God is good and worthy of our prayers, even if he doesn't answer them. We absolutely need the book of Proverbs. We need to learn how to be humans. according to God's design. Proverbs helps us know this. We simply can't afford to spend the rest of our lives thinking deeply about every action that we'll take. And so Proverbs trains us in simple, no-nonsense living, the kind that will be right most of the time. But if we live in Proverbs, if we never move past Proverbs, if our pastor only ever tells us what to do and fills our lives with three easy steps for a better life, then we will always reduce God to a formula. We will make God someone we can handle, we can get into our hands, we can make do what we want. Someone that we can figure out. I'm always nervous when I think I've figured God out. That's where Ecclesiastes confronts us and calls us into a deeper relationship with God. Because God can't be boiled down to a few hundred easy steps or proverbs. The God who created us is so deeply beautiful and mysterious that we could spend the rest of eternity searching him out, trying to understand him, only to find that we've barely skimmed the surface. Ecclesiastes demands that we give God our whole minds. And I want to suggest that if Ecclesiastes doesn't have a place in our spiritual lives as part of our spiritual nourishment, then we are probably far too often not giving our minds over to God in some deeply formative ways. Because while Proverbs is helpful for living and loving God with our whole strength, it barely begins our education in who God is. And if we don't know who God is, I just promise you this, you are in deep trouble the moment all of your life's accomplishments become rubble. And they will become rubble. The moment your highest highs are nothing more than breath exhaled, right? Like the thing that you were living for, the thing that defines your life, the moment it's just gone. When everything we've done or looked for or built or attained is all meaningless and empty, laid bare in front of us, if we haven't found the Creator, we're in deep trouble. Not because we're somehow so distant from him that we can't somehow reconnect, but because we will be like floaters in an ocean with nothing mooring us, nothing to hang on to. Without a firm foundation, everything else in our lives, all of our good living will fall through our fingertips just as the wind. Ecclesiastes brings us to that firm foundation. Whatever else is vanity, whatever else is meaningless or empty, this much can be said. According to Ecclesiastes, fear God. Seek him. For in him, everything holds together. And I'll give you a taste of where we're going next week. We'll be in the Song of Songs. Not only do all things hold together, but in the Song of Songs, we're told the love of God defeats even death. Which means the thing that so powerfully marks and reminds us of the meaningless of everything, our deaths, the end of it all, the love of God defeats death. And that's where we find ourselves at the end of this morning's sermon and every sermon, an invitation to come to the table, the place where we remember that if God can take a cross, an instrument of torture, a symbol of pure meaninglessness, and redeem it and make it a symbol of life, then what else can God do with the things that would otherwise be meaningless and vapor and breath in our lives? This is the question that we're invited to consider as we come to the table this morning, to ask Jesus honestly, what does it mean for me to pursue all of this good, but in the midst of it all, to chase solely after you?